The Book Nook on WYSO is made possible by five local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Clark County Public Library, the Dayton Metro Library, and the Wright Memorial Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'm delighted to welcome back to the program today Scott Rabb. Hello, Scott.
How are you, Vic?
Very, very well today, Scott. And that's not just because, as we're recording this, last night was the first game of the Eastern Division playoffs in the NBA. It's not because of that, Scott. You're probably in a good mood, though.
I'm in a pretty good mood. I got to say, that was a fun game last night.
You have just published a book called You're Welcome, Cleveland, How I Helped LeBron James Win a Championship and Save a City. And I'm sure some of our listeners out there are kind of scratching their heads going, huh, how do you do that? Who is this guy? How did you do it, Scott?
It's kind of tongue-in-cheek for anyone who thinks I actually had anything to do with winning an NBA championship or with saving a city that I still like to think of as kind of vibrant any time of year. But when LeBron left, I wrote a very angry book, published in late 2011, and I wasn't expecting him to come back. Once he did, and won a championship and ended that drought on Father's Day in an epic comeback against the 73-9 Golden State Warriors, I felt it was my duty, not just kind of an apologia of sorts for the first book, but to celebrate the championship. So that subtitle, and kind of like the first book, which was called, as you know, the Horror of Akron, overstated, not meant entirely seriously, and yet.
We had you on for the Horror of Akron, and
yes, sir.
You were somewhat embittered.
I would say you're being kind, and I appreciate it. I've thought about it a lot over the years, and certainly since the Cavs and LeBron ended the 52-year drought. On the one hand, I felt looking back that I hung an entire lifetime of humiliation and defeat, personal and as a sports fan, a Cleveland sports fan. I framed it all with the decision by a young athlete, the greatest, certainly the greatest athlete Northeast Ohio has ever produced, and I say that with all due respect to Jesse Owens in particular. But I felt I left it all out on the court in the first book. I tried to do the same thing with the new one, and the bitterness and that kind of rage that came with LeBron's departure to Miami. Turns out, really wasn't about LeBron at all. Something that we all have to wrestle with, ourselves. It's a lifelong struggle, et cetera, et cetera. In truth, though, that June 19th, 2016, Father's Day, in Cleveland, at a sports bar with my son, watching the Cavaliers, led by LeBron, win that championship was the best night of my life. So I tried to write a book, just as honest as the first one, that really was a mix of joy and kind of the wonder that comes along with knowing how stupid being this obsessive and emotional about sports teams are, just trying to parse that a little bit more.
We are here in Southwest Ohio speaking to you out there in New Jersey. You carry Cleveland in your heart, even though you haven't lived there for a long time, but you grew up there, you suffered there as a sports fan, and in that first book, you talked a lot about the suffering. I'm sure we have many listeners out there who are Cleveland fans or have gone through some of the same suffering. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about the humiliation of being a Cleveland fan for all those years and what it felt like to finally have that change.
It was all the sports humiliation. Was all for me as an expat, as someone who left Cleveland for grad school back in the '80s. I still have family, including my mother there. I make literally a dozen trips a year, not just for sports, and I'm still involved at Cleveland State University, my alma mater. you're out in the world, and I was working for Esquire magazine and at GQ, you know, writing for magazines the last 30 years, and the sports humiliation in Cleveland's case is so inextricably bound with the downward spiral that the city's been in terms of population and everything that goes along with that. It became a national. I was born in 1952, so I saw it become a national punchline as the late 60s and then certainly the early and mid 70s rolled along. The teams, not the Browns in that era, but you know, the teams were both boring and just doomed. I don't need to tell anyone, you know, what the hideous history of Cleveland sports really is. So out in the world, or in the world I was inhabiting, you know, you always, when you're from Cleveland, you kind of lead with Cleveland, or at least that's how it always feels to me. We're everywhere. You know, Northeast Ohioans who've left, you know, partly because, gosh, I really couldn't have made a living as a writer in Cleveland, Ohio. It's just a fact of the matter. But, you know, those teams came to represent, not just to me, but certainly in the entire country, those teams were Cleveland. The Browns now, you know, are perceived generally as a disgrace, but because the Cavs have won a championship, because the Tribe is as good as the Tribe really is now. I think people's, you know, you can't measure it in economic terms because a lot of that is BS. The impact of the local sports team or local sports hero on you know, raising everyone's standard of living is mostly a myth promulgated by owners of teams and politicians to get more taxpayer funds to help keep the palaces maintained. But in truth, my truth, as I've lived it out there on the road, is that Cleveland really is those teams. Those teams are Cleveland, and part of my, not embarrassment and certainly not shame, but part of my attitude and the grudge I was carrying toward the teams and toward the perception of the city, the area itself, the world at large, was, you know, reality-based. I just had a meal yesterday here in North Jersey. A friend of mine came out from New York City. We go to a diner in East Newark, and the server says, finds out we're from Cleveland and says, you know, I feel sorry for you. So that stuff's still going on. Uh-huh. But sports-wise, no one can trash talk the Tribe or the Cavs anymore.
Scott Rapp joins us. His book is You're Welcome, Cleveland, How I Helped LeBron James Win a Championship and Save a City. After they finally won it all, with that amazing finish, which you doubted right to the last second that they could pull it off, did you go out on the street and burn that ticket stub you've been carrying around?
I retired the stub. I would never burn that stub. That was the night, December 27th, 1964. I'm 12 years old. Cleveland is still, you know, a throbbing, pulsing, you know, industrial hub, and the Browns are the world champion, touchdown underdogs against the Johnny Unitas Colts. I mean, I've been going on about this for 53 years and counting, but I would never burn that stuff. I did retire it. Uh-huh. I did. You know, there's a small safe that contains, like, the deed to the house. Uh-huh. That's where the ticket stub is resting comfortably.
Nice. And last October, you know, I really thought that in that seventh game, the Indians had the Cubs. If it hadn't started raining, they'd knocked Aroldis Chapman around, the closer for the Cubs. Didn't you really think they had it?
Yeah. When Rajai Davis tied it with that home run, and it remains one of the greatest moments I've had, and I think a lot of us have had as Cleveland sports fans. It felt meant to be. Mm. Not the first time for a Cleveland team, but I was writing about this last night, just kind of journaling. You know, I'm not on assignment anymore, thank goodness. And at that point, even after they lost in extra innings to the Cubs, one of the key truths of my emotional reaction afterwards was that, you know what, the crucial thing is that the Cavs ended the drought. That mm-hmm. that had the Cavs not completed that epic comeback and Cleveland had lost the World Series in Game 7 at home, I'm not sure. I've been despondent, certainly, at certain points in my life as a Cleveland fan, but that had the Cavs not won the championship, so you lose a Game 7 for the NBA crown, and a Game 7 for the World Series. Maybe about now, this many months later, I might have been able to pick up the phone and say, hello?
Scott Rapp joins us. His book is You're Welcome, Cleveland. Was this book, in a way, an act of contrition?
It was an act of contrition in a couple of ways. It's never going to sound anything other than disingenuous. But I wrote the first book. The first book was a miracle. I set out the year before to write a happy book when LeBron hadn't become a free agent, hadn't left for Miami, and all that fury and all that. I wrote this in the new book. If I was going one-on-one with LeBron or any other pro, you rolled the basketball on the court for real and for real money, they would show no mercy, and I showed no mercy in the first book. And some of the, you keep growing. You hope you keep growing. Coming to terms with suddenly being the angry Cleveland guy, a guy who wrote a book with a title like The Horror of Akron about a young athlete who simply made a decision he felt was best for him and his family and all that, there was some contrition involved, especially because, I'm not writing. I'm not a nonprofit organization. I was a magazine hack, for 30 years. It's not false modesty. It's the truth of the matter is, I write for money, and I had made money on the first book. I'm coming back for another book. It felt greedy. It felt a little embarrassing almost. But damn it, I insist I have a heart, and that's where I try to write from. And so the second book became somewhat contrite. I mean, I wouldn't change the title. I wouldn't change a word. You write what you write, and you hope you're not wasting your time and anyone else's. But in this case, at least early on, I didn't want to pretend I had not written that first book, and I didn't want to assume that everyone knew I'd written the first book. So pretty early on in You're Welcome, Cleveland, I think I take at least a few thousand words and throughout the book to kind of speak directly, as it were, to LeBron James, because as it struck me one Yom Kippur, one day of atonement, when I was sitting outside the synagogue, which is where I prefer to sit during services, I realized LeBron has kids. These are real human beings, not two-dimensional subjects of my emotional self-pleasure. And that those kids would know the existence of a book, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, there's some real contrition involved there. I it's always going to sound disingenuous, but it's felt.
I, as a basketball fan, really enjoyed reading the book from the aspect of that, because there's just so much basketball in us. You take us to so many games, and many of these games you attended with your son. Your son's a big part of the story. And you make the case that Michael Jordan is not the greatest basketball player ever, that it's LeBron. Explain why you think that.
I watched Michael's whole career. I was living in Iowa, from 84 to 91, talking about last century. And it's not a lack of respect for Michael Jordan. And for any Cleveland fan, you can't dismiss the six rings and six finals. But I think you can make a very, very first of all, let's give Kareem Abdul-Jabbar his due.
Mm-hmm.
I think centers, whether it's Kareem, whether it's Bill Russell, are kind of in a separate category, especially the dynastic linchpins. But my God, when you've watched a lifetime of basketball and you see the range of skills, I saw Oscar Robertson play at the Cleveland Arena. The Cincinnati Royals played a few home games a year in Cleveland. I was a boy, but I wasn't blind. So I've seen over the years Elgin Baylor. I mean, I've seen generations. And Michael Jordan, you can argue he's the greatest of all time, and obviously you're still with the majority. But I've watched – I'm not saying there's no hometown bias here. There most certainly is. But I've watched LeBron. I was not in Cleveland and watching him as he was coming up, St. Fitz and St. Mary. But from the time he came in the league – through now, his blend of skills, including the durability, including the intelligence, the on-court wisdom that has only grown over the years, is the greatest basketball player I've ever seen. So you take that kind of, well, I know, I trust what I've seen with my eyes, but you can also go to look, I'm no numbers cruncher, but on basketballreference.com and other sites, you know, John Hollinger, anyway, I'm just saying, by the numbers too, there are basically two players in this conversation as far as the all-round, pound-for-pound, you know, GOAT, the greatest of all time. I think you can make an argument for LeBron, partly because the book, the final chapter on the court, has yet to be written, and what he's doing at this age, I've never seen the like of. And I, again, it doesn't have to be, I'm a Kobe guy, I'm a Michael guy, I'm a LeBron guy, but in this case, I think anyone who's taking a look at the numbers sees also that this is not some stretch, this is not some contrarian Cleveland-centric point of view. There are two guys in the conversation, you know, for the greatest of all time NBA player, given that range of skills, et cetera, it's Michael and LeBron. If I were a GM starting a franchise and I had my choice of either of the two players, including the kind of teammate they are, I mean, Michael never won a title without Scottie Pippen. I'm sorry, I'm starting to yell here. Anyway, I try to address this at length in the book, too. You can make a very strong argument that LeBron James is on his way to becoming, by acclaim, by consensus, the greatest of all time. I've been saying that for a couple of years. Now, I said it in the first book. I never, ever said otherwise, despite my fury at LeBron's treachery.
A ring number four wouldn't hurt, would it, Scott?
Back to back, in a you know, best of three with a truly great Golden State Warriors team. I mean, everything went the Cavs' way last year in the finals. Cleveland finally got lucky in that sense, but even so, to come back, you know, from down 3-1 to a team that had set a regular season record for wins, that was mythic. And if they can do that back-to-back against the Warriors, that fourth ring, ending the drought, et cetera, you talk about a legacy. I mean, yeah, all due respect to everyone who's ever played the game, LeBron James really in some ways would stand alone.
You spend quite a bit of time in the book, You're Welcome, Cleveland, in that season that preceded the championship season, the one where David Blatt was still coaching the Cavaliers. And Blatt doesn't come off very well in your book.
In a way, there's no trilogy here, but in a way, I've thought about this. I mean, because of my background, you know, there's a lot of politics in the book. There's a lot of Jewishness in the book. I mean, you know, these are both LeBron books are really turned out to be, and it wasn't planned that way, but kind of narcissistic, kind of memoirs and all that. And Blatt just, there's something about a guy, you know, he went to Princeton. You know, he's an East Coast Jew. He did his thesis on Bernard Malamud, and on page, I think, two or three of his thesis, his Princeton undergrad thesis, he uses an epigraph from Malamud that I use as an epigraph for The Whore of Akron. So I was fascinated by David Blatt from the get-go, studied him because I didn't know who he was really. You know, looked at press conferences he'd done as a EuroLeague coach, and what struck me was both his intelligence and his arrogance. And I, like everyone else, when he was hired to coach a Cavs team that didn't know LeBron was coming back, I was really excited. You know, he's got, you know, young Dion Waiters, and he's got Andrew Wiggins and Kyrie, and they'll grow together. All of a sudden, he's not coaching that team. He's coaching this team. And you know, some of living mostly in Israel, you know, for his entire adult life and coaching in the EuroLeague, he was a stranger to NBA culture. And listen, there's a lot of race in the book, too. I mean, I had to come to terms in both books with the fact that I'm a white guy, a media white guy, an old media white guy who's writing obsessively about a young black, you know, male athlete. I mean, this is, you know, I'm not saying I can plumb those depths successfully, but it would be really cowardly not to try. So the Blatt thing for me, maybe Blatt became, you know, he doesn't come off well, especially in his disdain for the idea that he is an underling now. The NBA coach is not a EuroLeague coach. He doesn't really run the show. He has to find ways to get buy-in, and in this case, from LeBron, whose consciousness, I think with the Heat, look, I don't know the man. I don't know LeBron James, but when the Heat stood with hoodies on to express solidarity with Trayvon Martin after Trayvon's murder, I mean, LeBron is trying, at least from the outside, to come to terms with being, and even in his letter announcing his return, to fulfill a calling, you know, beyond what he does on the basketball court. So that part, the part where Blatt comes into an essentially African-American league and you know, tries, I don't think very successfully, to be the boss of a team of grown men who don't know him and don't care that he won 700 EuroLeague games, and the clash and the friction, et cetera, that just fascinated the hell out of me. You know, any reader can decide, you know, maybe a little too much, but yeah, that really got me where I live.
That really is the meat of the book that season, and of course another Cleveland heartbreak at the end of it. But then we have that wonderful next season, and in many ways you're making amends for that first book, and you're also saying, you know, I was wrong, because – in that first book, you were kind of mocking LeBron's group. I hate to call call him a posse, but he's got these old friends from Akron, and you were kind of tough on them. And now you're admitting, well, maybe I was kind of dumb.
Hey, life really, my goodness, you know, not to digress wildly, but yeah, I was writing the book as the, you know, presidential campaign was unfolding after the Cavs won in June. I had 14 weeks, you know, to produce 50,000 words. So part of it is bound up, you know, with how fractured we are as a culture. But yeah, when I look back at the first book and referring to, you know, LeBron grew up with Maverick Carter and Rich Paul, I think Randy Mims, LeBron, LRMR, these. And I wasn't outright, you know, race baiting, but it was me being very dismissive. Yeah, the Akron chapter of Mensa, you know, these guys are going to put together a campaign to make LeBron James a global icon, and it was very, very implicitly racist.
Yeah.
But also, then life as life goes, it turns out LeBron James and his friends, family, business partners. I mean, these guys really, really are family. Been together, you know, and they're young men. Yeah, they're invited to Harvard Business School, you know, to present. And you know, I'm on the road doing a magazine, you know, feature on Bob Odenkirk. Not that that's not wonderful, but yeah, I think I was wrong. And I think part of the reason I was wrong is it's easy for an old white guy to look at young black men and go,
Yeah. Well, at least you admit it. Scott Rapp joins us. His book is You're Welcome, Cleveland, How I Help LeBron James Win a Championship and Save a City. You spend a lot of time in this book driving through Pennsylvania. Sometimes you're with your son. You're always afraid a deer is going to come running out in front of the car. You've got to find a restroom. We learn a lot about you, Scott. And I'm wondering, did you keep track of how much you spent on tickets to go see Cleveland?
Part of my act of contrition is toward HarperCollins, too, my publisher. We were hoping to put out a book the year before because none of us saw Golden State coming. But yeah, I had to keep track of everything, partly because that's expenses. Those are Schedule C travel expenses, but partly because it became, you know, again, I really, you know, very lucky. I'm a very lucky guy and a very lucky writer. This has been my obsession my whole life, is Cleveland sports teams, and the idea of writing one book, much less two, where I can work that out on the page, pretty miraculous to me. But so yeah, the whole I-80 thing, getting to know almost every exit on I-80, and as my, you know, my body has aged, in particular my prostate, you know, the BPH. Thank God nothing serious. Yeah, you really get to know, you know, the woods and the weeds off I-82 and the weather. So and my son was becoming a driver over the course of the book, the two seasons passed. And so this became, you compare yourself to any of the expat writers, you know, that have come down through the years, that's, I'm a very, very poor man's Cleveland version of anything like James Joyce. But the truth is, I-80 for me has been the mother road. When I lived in Iowa, I mean, I've made hundreds of trips to Cleveland, and certainly not all for sports, but I-80 weather, and I got mixed up. I wrote about the Lordstown plant, you know, when you pass Youngstown on I-80 in the book. I realized I got the direction wrong. It's not west of Cleveland, it's east of Cleveland, but you know, these things, like my son and I commuting to playoff games in Cleveland, or flying back on a 6 a.m. plane because he had to take, you know, a final exam. He's still in high school.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of crazy, but what am I? You know, there are some great books out. Brian Windhorst and Dave McMenamin's Return of the King. There have to be like 10 books out right now about the Cavaliers winning the championship. Mine is probably the weirdest, is all I can say. The weirdest.
Well, I don't think of you as a particularly sentimental guy, but there's a certain poignant quality to this book. You're meditating on your own mortality in spots, which,
yeah,
you know, is pretty interesting to read.
It was, the timing was very strange. Nothing cosmic. I don't believe in angels. Have trouble even staying agnostic rather than atheist. But my father died the morning of Game 3. Now, that my parents have been divorced since I was a little boy, and he and I were on and off very estranged over the years. So it wasn't the kind of burden, emotional burden. It was just the kind of thing where you know, my father passes the morning of Game 3, and you know, as time goes by, and this has been true my whole life, growing up without a dad, in those years, you know, living 2,000-3,000 miles of growing up, you know, without a parent, you know, fatherhood for me has been redemptive in the sense of just feeling, you know, all the feelings, because I was old. I was 10 when my folks split up, so I was old enough that that hole in my life became my life in a lot of ways. So, you know, luckily, you know, being lucky enough to become a father and later in life and all that, and as the years went by, and you grow apart. So Cleveland sports is really, you know, what I mean, a lot of things bind me to my son, but the one thing we can enjoy together without any, you know, there's no power struggle, there's no young man and old man clashing. You're just Cleveland fans and your father and son, and you realize he's going off to school in a couple of months. That became increasingly important as I was writing the book, as we have this thing. See, we saw them win. You know, we saw, you know, the Cavaliers end this drought. We, you know, just that, you know, you don't want to infuse it with you know, the saccharine stuff, but my God, there's a reason things are cliches, and the reason, you know, that I didn't know that we'd ever see. It's hard to win a championship. I don't care how much talent you assemble in any sport. We've all seen Cleveland teams that certainly were good enough, and they never got it done. So, you know, there was always a chance. You don't know what tomorrow's going to bring, or even later today, that we never would have had the experience of watching, being together watching a Cleveland team win a title. So, you know, that hopefully, you know, any reader's not neck deep in that stuff, but yeah, that certainly for me was you know, my gratitude for seeing that happen, and you know, to LeBron and the rest of the people I excoriated in both books. I mean, at bottom, that's how I, you know, it's like Rickles. I kid because I love.
I love it. The book is You're Welcome, Cleveland: How I Helped LeBron James Win a Championship and Save a City. Scott Rabb wrote it. He's been my guest on the program today. It's a love letter to Cleveland, to LeBron and the Cavs, who are trying to win another championship, and to your family. And we really appreciate the time, Scott.
Oh, my pleasure, Vic. Thank you.
You've been listening to The Book Nook. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McInnes.